Welcome to Filmstrip. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Lindsay.
I'm Ron.
I'm Jay.
And this is our review of National Lampoon's European Vacation, starring Chevy Chase, Beverly D'Angelo, Dana Hill, Jason Lively, Victor Lanoux, and Eric Idle. Directed by Amy Heckerling and released in 1985 on a $17 million budget, it grossed over $49 million at the box office. So let's talk about National Lampoon's November. And I just read that note, Jay. I wasn't supposed to read that whole thing. Okay, boys, it is National Lampoon's November, which I threw out to you as a potential theme for the month of November, because what says family like National Lampoon's, right? This is the time of family and holidays. For better or for worse, National Lampoon's.
Yeah, one way or the other, you know, vacation movies are definitely a part of that world, though. I think I know National Lampoon's was a publication and everything, but in terms of film stuff, I want to say Animal House was the thing that really broke them into that world, which, confession, guys, I didn't see Animal House till I was in college. So it was one of those, like I said in a group of people, I've never seen that. And then my Tuesday night was full. But the vacation movies is a different story, as we'll get to.
Well, what's your history, Jay, Ron, with the European Vacation or any of the vacation movies? They're kind of a package deal.
Well, I think that every family has the Christmas Vacation as sort of their go-to. This is like Christmas with our family because it's a complete disaster kind of thing. But originally, National Lampoon's Vacation was kind of a meme for my dad and my uncle and our various family vacations that we all took together, because we would all pile in my dad's van and drive from Kentucky to Florida or Kentucky to Myrtle Beach or Kentucky to wherever we were going. But it was always in the van, and there was always some sort of ridiculous thing that happened on the road that mimicked something in a vacation movie.
Yeah, I have seen every one of these movies in a theater, and three of them with my entire family. Vegas Vacation is the only one I didn't see with them, but my parents took me, my brother, and both of themselves to see the original Vacation. In fact, they went to see it with another couple on like a date night and thought it was so funny and decided, you know, the objectionable stuff in it, we'll just cover their eyes and these boys won't pick up on it. That was wrong. But anyway, I got a lot of Christy Brinkley early on. But anyway, they took us to see it. So we saw Vacation, and then we went and saw European Vacation because we were like, oh, heck yeah, it's the same thing. Saw that again. Of course, we saw Christmas Vacation in theaters because it looked like, of course, it was a blast. And then I went and saw Vegas Vacation because, like, well, I have to complete the quadrilogy, and I should have just rented it. But yeah, I've seen all of these. And the thing was, my family didn't do the big fam vacation until I was a good bit older. And most of it centered around driving to see my brother where he went to college in New York. And we lived in the South, so that was always a good 22-hour drive up and down 81 and through, you know, the Mid-Atlantic and Pennsylvania. Or we could go the other way, which was through Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, and cut across Pennsylvania and get there. So I've seen a lot of that part of the world. And we got one of those conversion van situations during that time. And so spent a lot of time riding in one of those and stuff. But I was a big Chevy Chase fan and have been, you know, for most of my life. I've seen him in so much stuff. And so I'm kind of usually a sucker to watch him do, you know, some of his shtick.
Please tell me you went to see National Lampoon's Family Vacation in a station wagon.
We did have a 1983 Ford LTD station wagon. So yes, it was not the family. It's not the family truckster, but it is the car think it wasn't long before my mom had the wreck in it and we got the Honda, the first Honda we had. But yeah, it's the first car I ever saw a movie in because my parents took us to see Coal Miner's Daughter. The first movie I saw in a theater experience, it was at a drive-in in North Alabama. Nice. So yeah, I remember watching Tommy Lee Jones say words I didn't know existed. one of his finer performances, but yeah, yeah. So yeah, we actually saw it in a station wagon.
Fantastic. I love it. I, as you know, am on record saying that National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation is one of my top five movies, favorite movies of all time, not just Christmas movies, folks, anytime. And I had seen Vegas Vacation a million times too. I'd seen European Vacation a number of times. We actually just watched it twice in 1 month, the second time being today. And I realized tonight, right before logging on, that I've never seen the first National Lampoon's Family Vacation. So,
wow. Oh, we're gonna get to that one next summer. Yeah. Woo.
I couldn't believe it. I feel so wholly unprepared, but I can at least talk about the other three.
The beautiful part of this series is that besides the characters' names, there's very little that ties between them. Like they're interdependent of each other, which makes them, it's an interesting series in that way, because you really only have to know really Clark and Ellen, and really just Clark to get the through lines through them. There's characters that come and go out of them, but and then the running joke,
the kids are different every time.
Yeah. Which was only a joke because they couldn't get the ones back for this one. And then they just decided, well, we'll just do it with different kids every time. And it was kind of a running gag, but because Ellen and Clark get older and older, and the kids roughly stay in the same teenage place. But
well, except Rusty gets way younger in Christmas Vacation.
He does. That's because Johnny Galecki's like 3 feet tall. And so, he got younger there. And then he became Ethan Embry in Vegas Vacation, if memory serves. But
honestly, I really like Vegas Vacation. I'm just going to throw that out there.
It's been a very long time since I bothered with it. So it would be worth a revisit someday. But no, the original though, Lindsay, yeah, you gotta tear the Band-Aid off of that one, because that's got so much, like, the tropes in that movie are so, like, weave through 80s comedy, like, all over the place. And it's because of the people behind it. We should say, like, they're not involved in this movie. John Hughes is really the author of the original Vacation story, and it's just him riffing on his family vacations. He wrote stories about it, and then Harold Ramis turned it into this comedic genius thing, because as Harold Ramis proved throughout his career, give him the most difficult actor in the world and he can squeeze the greatest performances out of him. He did it with Murray a couple of times, did it with Chevy a few times. He just knows how to get, I think because he was a real laid-back dude and he just knew how to get the stuff out of him. And he also knew Beverly D'Angelo was a huge star, and you just kind of let her go and she does great things. So
she does do great things. Yes, I was shocked myself. I don't know why I thought that I'd seen it. Maybe because I watched the others so many times, I had just assumed in my heart I've seen it. And then we watched the trailer and I was like, I don't recognize any of this. So I guess that's on the list for tomorrow night of things to watch.
I quote National Lampoon's Vacation all the time. Especially if I'm driving through.
Wait, what's your top quote? Oh, can you say it?
Yeah. Anytime I drive through a bad neighborhood, I say, well, roll them up.
Roll them up. Hey, Maeve, do you want to notice the plight?
Yeah.
So exactly. I've actually done the whole, you see where it say this, that, I mean, forget that, you don't want to go that way. Yeah, I've done that to people, giving them directions before. So, Lindsay, when you see the movie, you'll know exactly what we're talking about. But
excellent.
Yeah, right. No, I drove through St. Louis once, and it wasn't that far of an experience from what that movie was like.
Honestly, that tracks with driving through St. Louis. That tracks with driving through Memphis. That tracks through driving through a lot of places I probably shouldn't have gone.
Right. Yes. Yeah, very Memphisy. So I agree. So
very Memphisy.
Yeah.
Well, let's get into European vacation before we get into the nitty gritty. Jay, can you give us a plot summary?
Yeah, I'm just going to kind of hit it on the high notes because I figure we're, you know, this is a bunch of scenes through pieces in Europe, but we'll talk about it. So the Griswolds win a family vacation on a game show that sends them on a tour of Western Europe. The kids aren't really into it as Clark and Ellen. Audrey has a boyfriend, Jack, played by 80s king douchebag William Zabka. And while Rusty's obsessed with just finding some love on his own. Reluctantly, though, the kids agree once Clark comes up with a voting system for the family to decide what to do each stop. So they get to London and they have several auto accidents, one involving Eric Idle that becomes like a running joke. And then they even get stuck in a roundabout for a whole day, which I have felt that pain in my own life. And they went to Stonehenge where the demons dwell and the banshees live, and they do live well, where Clark backs into one of the monoliths and knocks them all over like a bunch of dominoes. They make it to Paris, and unfortunately, the family video recorder, which is the size of like a television news recorder today, is stolen, in which a Va Va Vroom sex tape Clark and Ellen made before they left is still on it. In West Germany, Clark turns a Bavarian folk dance into an all-out brawl as he and the family flee. And then in Rome, they run afoul of some thieves who are posing as a rental car agent, and Ellen sees a billboard advertising her body scene with Clark, which is apparently a really popular film in the area. The family splits, all mad at each other. Clark goes off on his own, invents selfies, by the way, with an Instamatic camera. We'll talk about that. But he misses his family, and of course he finds that Ellen has been taken hostage by these thieves, and he uses his specific set of bumbling skills to chase them down with authorities in tow, and they all land in a fountain. Reunited and feeling so good on the flight back home, Clark of course bumbles and stumbles into the pilot's cabin, causing the plane to run through the Statue of Liberty's torch, turning it upside down as credits roll. Which is funny because the Griswolds are famously from Chicago, but we end the movie in New York because I'm sure O'Hare doesn't fly to London, but whatever. That's the
O'Hare does fly to London because that's how I flew to London.
Yeah, see already plot holes, problems. So
maybe they didn't fly to London in 1985 though.
We don't know. We don't know. That's fair. But yeah, that's the highlights of the movie. I think it's really got five big scene pieces. It's the opening and then all the spots through Europe that take us through this film.
So the opening game show was, I guess, a parody of a few different game shows, and the bits were hilarious. When I first saw it, again, recently, I watched it twice in 1 month. So the first viewing of it, I was like, boy, that game show host making out with all those women look really familiar. What game show did that happen on?
That was Richard Dawson.
Family Feud. Family Feud, yeah.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yeah. And I remember watching that. And I do remember him just like right on the lips, kissing every single woman
and,
on that
and
show.
The way he got drive-bys on Rusty is exactly what Richard Dawson would do to the boys. Like, how you doing there, Ron? Hey, Lindsay. It would just lay the 70 schmooze on. It was hilarious.
Well, then he full on like makes out with Audrey, and all I could think was, she looks like she is 13. How old is she supposed to be? I know she was
that
21.
Did not stop Richard Dawson.
No. John Astin playing a creep is a choice that I didn't know I was ready for, but it totally works, right?
All right, which one of us is going to do the Arnold Schwarzenegger line from Running Man, in which one of us is going to be Richard Dawson. So one of us has to say, Gillian, I'll be back. And then the other one has to say, only in reruns. And he shoots him down the tube.
Yes. Running Man, by the way, if you haven't revisited that one in a while, that's worth a shot because I've actually read the book that it's based on, and those are very, very different experiences.
I really like the book.
I did too. I kind of wish they would actually make it.
So, someone's apparently doing that, by the way.
Good. That needs to be done. So, but back to European Vacation and the pig in a poke, which we also have to talk about that whole thing.
It's like Family Double Dare meets, Family Feud.
That, thank you. I was trying to think, what was the one where people dressed up in costume that wasn't Let's Make a Deal? And I forgot about Double Dare. Yeah.
Well, they didn't really dress in costume. They were like jumpsuits with
like matching
knees and elbows pads.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was matching outfits. What? And
okay, I'm too old to really remember this, but I just remember it sort of on the periphery of my teenage years. What was the game show where Rockapella did the intro? You know what I'm talking about, the acapella band?
Where in the was world is Guts? Carmen? Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Thank you. See, I was too old to really like do the Carmen Sandiego situation, but I knew them.
Carmen Sandiego.
Yep.
I love that show.
Yeah, I love Rockapella, and I wish they were a part of this because it would have made Digging a Pope more interesting.
Fun fact, Jay, as a fat child, I would watch Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego while walking on a treadmill.
There, wow. Oh, there you go.
7:30, yeah.
I mean, I was walking on a treadmill when I watched this. So how fun is that? I was on an exercise bike for part of it and on a treadmill for the rest. So
I was sitting on the couch while I watched it.
I mean, John Astin aside and sort of his whole lecherous thing or whatever, it is funny how both of the men in these families completely and totally ignore the advice of their family, which is the joke, right? They all have the answer. And it's like, no, it's blue or whatever. They'd always get something wrong on Family Feud. It's funny.
And it's funny because the other dad was 80s mainstay Paul Bartel,
mm-hmm.
who was in Chopping Mall. As the husband of Mary Warrenoff.
See, it has been so long since I've seen Chopping Mall. Watching it again would be like the first time almost. It's been so many years.
Why has it been so long, Jay? It's on Shudder. Joe Bob did it.
I know. The reason is because we just got out of October, and I made myself watch 31 new to me scary things, so I didn't revisit anything except like the Halloween movies that month that I wanted to watch. And so if you want to know what I think about that, go to my Letterbox page. It's all there. But yeah, Chopping Mall maybe on the day through, because I kind of felt like this dad was sort of a cross between Frank Oz and some other annoying semi-bald 80s man, you know, like he just sort of had that school teacher jerk vibe. But I love it, like they all had like, you know, Nobel Peace Prizes or were working for, you know, the IBM or whatever, which is hilarious that was the thing, you know, in the day. But
no, they didn't use IBM because IBM would have made it pay to use the name.
This is true. It's whatever fake version of that game.
They called it like
a software company.
Yeah, yeah. It was a Computech or something. It was like the fake version of Microsoft.
Yeah, or Compaq or whatever. CompuServe
or whatever. But yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that part was very funny because the difficulty difference between the two questions was like a whiplash effect, because one of those questions was incredibly easy and that was incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
Which I guess tracks for like a rigged game show.
Right. Completely. Right. That's the whole point.
Totally rigged. Well, then they end up winning with Ellen's exclamation of Clark.
Yeah. Lewis and Clark. That's correct.
The answer.
Yeah. Yep. And I was like, oh, that's hilarious. So, but you know, I love it. I love it at the end. Like, Astin carries forward the whole bit, like he's like totally like molestering poor Audrey in the background as they're going to commercial.
Okay,
but she doesn't hate it.
That brings up the question: how old was Audrey supposed to be?
I took like 15, maybe
that's
16.
What I was saying, like 15, 16. Yeah. She's definitely in high school, and she's older than Rusty, I think.
Yeah.
And he's only 13.
Right.
He's a really tall, lanky, awkward 13-year-old.
It's
like a baby giraffe.
Although, to be fair, if your father was Chevy Chase, you'd probably be a tall, awkward looking 13-year-old.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But Audrey looks like Dana Hall looks like she could have come from Beverly D'Angelo and Chevy Chase.
Mm-hmm.
Where did this ginger kid who's going to fight the creeps in a few years at college come from? Because I don't know if y'all recognize Jason Lively. We just talked about him and his other great moment in cinema history, which was taught in Night of the Creeps, because he does not look like he belongs. So,
well, the thing is, though, is Christmas Vacation establishes there's some red hair in the Griswold family.
That side of things, right?
Because he's got an uncle. Is it his uncle Rusty? Well, anyway, the old Aunt Beverly is like, is Rusty still in the Navy?
Yeah, you're right. So Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But in this one, it's fun how the kid, like the kid dynamic in the first one, I don't want to talk about it too much because Lizzie, you can see it, but okay. They're like brother and sister. They're brother and sister, so they have that kind of like picking at each other, but they're very much like on the same side in that movie. Anthony Michael Hall and Dana, I forget what her name with the actor's name was, that played his sister in that one. They're kind of a tag team in some ways. These two people don't want to talk to each other like at all. And what I love though is that they gave Audrey the boyfriend, and like as I said in the plot summary, they cast perfect 80s King douche William Zabka before he was that. But this is like post Karate Kid, so he was starting. This is before Back in the School and all that stuff. You know, he was in all of those, and he's great as Jack. It was like soap opera. I mean, I love that Jack stuff. So
she made him such a big part of the movie, and he was on screen for like maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah, they were making out by the grill. That was it.
But that's it. That's all they needed him for. Mm-hmm. They had all of his model shots that she had hanging up over the bed in London, I think it was.
Yeah, okay.
And I was like, I bet those were real. I cannot confirm. I did not look this up, but
yeah,
they look like those, actual actor headshot model shots. That
those were
had.
Definitely real because he was a staple of like the Tiger Beat magazine set.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. He was in all of that action. What I thought was great was that she took those with her and then just proceeded to recreate her bedroom in the hotels that they would stay whatever every night. I was like, damn, that is dedication. Audrey is loyal, is what I want to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Too sweet, sweet Audrey. So loyal. You know what? I feel like, and I haven't seen the original Vacation, but Audrey and Rusty, I feel like, don't really have a choice. They kind of have to be on the same side, even if they're picking at each other, because they're not in their home country.
Well, this is true.
It's just the four of them.
And when you've got Clark, who is just this whirlwind of disaster, and then Beverly D'Angelo, who's like the sweetest enabler of said disaster at all times. What it would be like to try and vacation with that, I can only imagine.
When they have the vote and she votes for Clark.
Yeah.
And two votes for Clark.
Yeah.
And it just reminds me, of, in the best way, I don't want this to come out like the wrong way, Ellen and Clark Griswold have the sweetest relationship, and it sometimes reminds me of my parents-in-law. Like, they're so sweet. But the whole thing, like when Ellen was like, I vote for Clark, and I was like, that's totally something my mother-in-law would do. Like, she's always, I mean, she doesn't, there's not much to enable, so I don't want to come off like there's all kinds of these crazy antics that go on in the Grellis home, but there could be.
Apparently the whole like Sparky nickname Beverly D'Angelo just came up with on her own, and she still calls Chevy that. Like, they're still friends, and she just came up with that during the first movie because she felt like they were from the generation where they would have the little pet name, and that she just sort of never let go of it. And I don't know, I just thought there's like a sweetness to that though, that it's just subtle, but it's an acting choice, and just she knows exactly when to call him Clark and then when to call him that, you know. And it's just cute. It's, and her whole little shower scene and stuff, like Beverly D'Angelo is like a big time singer and, you know, Broadway and all that, and apparently she demanded like, I have to sing in this, you have to let me do that at least in this movie. And that whole thing was just her, like, she improvised a lot of it and then they built the scene around it. But
she asked to sing.
She is a singer. She is a really good singer.
She got her start. If you ever wanted to check out her backstory, she did an episode of the Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast. That is phenomenal.
Yeah,
because she got her start like singing background for. Is she the one who lost her virginity to Tom Jones?
Might have been. I can't remember. But she
I want to say she lost her virginity to Tom Jones when she was like 15.
Yeah.
And then later became like a very in demand, like backup singer.
Yeah. And then, like I said, I know she did stage and all kinds of stuff, but this was kind of her. I always thought of her as kind of like that Roxy in Chicago kind of thing, you know, and, you know, Cell Block Tango kind of gal.
Yeah.
That's her vibe. But I'll say this, like, there's something about 80s movies, and John Hughes' name is on this, and he'll tell you, I wrote a zero of this. He said they took unused ideas from the first movie and stuck a couple of them in it, and thank God the Writers Guild knew that, and I got a credit for it. He said, that is mostly the other people, Amy Heckerling, he said, and a lot of it is Chevy and Beverly, who would just feed them, here's what we think should happen, and they would write stuff around for them, because those two were, they were improv. I mean, they were improv actors, and, you know.
And they're so good at their characters, and their dynamic with each other is so real and adorable and believable. I love it. And I guess she continued to call him Sparky after this. Like, that's just Beverly D'Angelo's pet name for Chevy Chase.
Yeah,
now.
They're still buddies, and she still calls him that. And she'll do it throughout all the movies. It's like her thing. And you hit on something though about them, is like that kind of sweetness can come off as kind of like Ward and June and kind of fake and sort of weird and stilted, unless the actors play it the way these two play it. There's like such a lived-in thing to them that mm-hmm. I don't have to, like, I can sit there and watch Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo, or I just slip into it and it's just Clark and Ellen Griswold and just the goofy people, and they're just that, and they're kind of wholesome but also a little bawdy, and, you know, that they're not as, you know, clean cut under the surface as you think, but, and they're not perfect, but they're very real, and they're fun, and they laugh, and they, you know, they cut up, and you can tell they got on well. And, you know, some of those movies, like, they talk about, like, the chemistry people have. It's usually if you see people with great chemistry, it's because they absolutely fucking hate each other. Like, you know, Officer and a Gentleman. I think Deborah Winger would still spit on Richard Gere today if she could get near him, because she hates him, and they have unreal chemistry in that movie. But sometimes people actually get along. You can kind of tell, like, these people got along. And when they do their, when he does his little video camera thing, apparently that was Chevy Chase's actual, like, personal camera. And he thought Clark would be the kind of guy that would have one of these and would, like, force it upon his family. So Clark Griswold 100%. Invents selfies and found footage movies in 1985. Everybody to know. Clark Griswold is responsible for all of that.
You know, it's funny, Jay, you were mentioning Coal Miner's Daughter earlier, and Beverly D'Angelo was nominated for a Golden Globe playing Patsy Cline.
Yeah, it's a hell of a performance, too. And she's not in it much, really, but she's good. The real Loretta said the things that got her the most were how well Sissy Spacek got her accent and could sing like her, because she didn't know, you know, anybody could do it. She said, and that was Patsy Cline on the screen. So it just made her cry, because her and Patsy were just that. And it's, if you haven't seen that one, that's a recommend on the side for everybody. Go check out Coal Miner's Daughter. It'll break your heart, but that movie's real good.
For all the positive attention that Chevy Chase gets for these movies, these are basically the Chevy Chase show, right? I feel like without Beverly D'Angelo, it doesn't work.
Oh, I agree. 100%.
I feel like she's 100% every good comedian needs a straight man.
Mm-hmm.
And she is the greatest straight man he could have. Mm-hmm. And B, their chemistry is so good that you believe someone like her would marry someone like him.
Totally. Yeah.
And that's the hardest thing. That's the thing that strains, you know, credibility the most. Because, I mean, in real life, she married a friggin' Italian count. And she was with Al Pacino for like 10 years. So, you know, this big goober. admittedly, he's played off as a mostly lovable goober in this. But, yeah, like.
But to his credit, Chevy's been married to the same woman for, like, 50 years or so now. And apparently a lot of the little things in their relationship are sort of bled over into this. And so he brought that with him. Yeah, he said it was a lot of the way he and his wife kind of get on is some of the way that he and Beverly D'Angelo would play. It's hard nowadays to get Chevy Chase to, like, one, be serious about anything and also not be a complete asshole at the same time. He's like a real jerk. But and there are moments when he kind of lets it down and he just sort of says stuff and in little fleeting pieces, like he told that story before, but mostly Beverly D'Angelo tells a lot of it. But she said that, you know, they just kind of, were themselves, but like the caricature versions of themselves. And he
and she also gets like the she also says like the funniest line in the movie to me. But we'll get to that when we get to Rome.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But no, she Ellen, I think, always has the best, like you say, the straight man part. And that's what makes her so fun and stuff. And she just sort of holds it all together, you know, because it's chaos otherwise.
She's this weird combination of like, she's this weird combination of like incredibly gorgeous in all these movies, but also like just the perfect foil to him. Mm-hmm. And I think a big part of that is because he's literally like a foot taller than she is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I feel like their physical, just those two together on screen is funny looking. And it's funny because it's like such a mismatch.
I think that's part of why I have ever gravitated toward these movies, because my parents were, it was a real disparity in height. My dad was 6'6". My mom was 5'2" on a good day. So they kind of looked like that. Now they weren't as goofy and all that. Sometimes they were, but not like this, but I could tell they liked it because what you just said, it reminded them of them, because they did look so funny standing next to each other all those years, because he was so much bigger than her.
Yeah. I think obviously replacing the kids in these movies is not difficult and turned into a gag throughout, but
yeah,
absolutely no way they would have been as funny without Beverly D'Angelo. Yeah. It wouldn't have happened.
I gotta give the kids a little credit though, because like I said, Dana Hall is playing this whole like just lovesick puppy the whole movie, which is not a lot to give an actor to do, but she really leans into it and has fun with it. And I love how Jason Lively is like the antagonistic little brother. Like, oh, I'm sure they won't mind you making long distance calls. Sure. You know, he has no idea. He's 13. He didn't win anything, you know. He's just hormones. He's hormones and headphones is what I called him. And which pretty much reminds me of being a teenager.
He was so, I mean, yes, he's just a tall, lanky teenager. And just the way he moves is so perfectly awkward.
Yeah.
Like in that dance scene when he falls asleep on the plane and they're all having their own special little dreams.
Yes.
On their way to Europe. And he is dancing with all these professional dancers and having so many professional good dancers around him in that setting just made him look even more out of place. And he would just like, there was one part where he like flipped up the hair or something of one of the dancers and it was so weird and awkward. But he was trying to be so
suave. Cool. Yeah. Like, I mean, he's so goofy. And that was a thing in the 80s. There were these movies like this, and you know, even his role in Night of the Creeps. But I think about like Anthony Edwards in this movie called Gotcha. I don't know if y'all have ever seen that, but he stars opposite of Natasha Kinski. He's like the sexy lady from the Cat People remake or whatever. And he is like so not in his league with that, because they try to make him play like this teenage guy that gets involved in all the spy craft and stuff. It's as bad as it sounds, but he does the same kind of awkward, like he talks all this tough stuff, but like every teenage boy, if you get around a girl that has real looks, you turn into a monkey. You don't know what you're doing. And I love how they just let him be a kid. And like, that's, you know, kids in movies, I think after the 80s and the early 90s, they started portraying kids in a certain way where like every kid was 25. You know, at all times, no matter how old they were. But these people act like actual teenagers, you know. And like, my brother was a teenager when this movie was made. He's a redhead. He wasn't lanky. But he's a redheaded kid. So I see Jason Lively. I see my brother when he was 13 and 14. It's funny.
He reminded me of my little redheaded brother too, Jay.
Oh, Lindsay, we have redheaded brothers in common.
We do.
Oh. So, yeah, how fun. But. No, but I love the gag. I got to ask, have y'all ever felt like what Clark gets into in London, where you're never going to get out of a damn roundabout? Because the first time I saw one, I did like everything else. I had no idea what I was doing. So
when we were in London, we had locals driving us around. And shout out to Sarah from Chillennial Horrors podcast and many different writing jobs, and one of the first people I ever gave a writing job to, and one of the people who got me the Den of Geek job that I still occasionally write at today. But they took us to this famous roundabout in St. Albans that's called the Magic Roundabout. It's literally like an intersection of like 8 or 9 different roundabouts that all come together. It's insane.
Oh my gosh.
And thankfully there was no one else on the road, so we were just able to drive around it in a big circle. And the whole time we were driving around, I thought, if this was an actual thing I had to deal with in America, I would just drive into oncoming traffic and let it kill me.
Yes.
My first time in a roundabout, I think I was driving toward DC, and they have some roundabouts in Maryland or something like that. I don't know. It was somewhere in that DC VA metro area. And I was absolutely terrified. I couldn't have been more than 20, 21. So I was still like a young-ish driver. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah. It's
very, very careful when I went around it.
Yeah. But I love that that's a trope and a joke. But the way that they play it, it's so great because he just gets stuck on it for so long that it's like this. Well, this is a little bit about my weird pop culture knowledge or whatever, but I grew up listening to like the Kingston Trio, and they've got this song about a guy that gets on the MTA and he can't get off because there was this fare hike going on where you could literally go from one station to the next, and if they changed the fare on you, you never had change, couldn't get off. So they wrote a song about this guy that couldn't get off the MTA. And
don't make me sing the song, Jay.
Yeah, I know you know what it is. I know you know what it is. But
yeah, because the Dropkick Murphys covered it. So
yeah. So that's a killer version of it, by the way, too. But I recommend the MTA song. But I had that in my head as I was listening to this, and I thought only if they could have licensed it would it have worked. It wouldn't have worked to the London scene, but it kind of almost works because they just go forever. Either that or the Yakety Sax from Benny Hill needed to be.
Oh yeah,
I'm stunned that this movie didn't have Yakety Sax at any point in the London scenes.
I just can only imagine that they couldn't get the license for it. I mean, $17 million is a lot of money for a movie in 1985, y'all. Like that's a lot of money for a movie. But and it's on the screen though. Like a lot of it is on the screen. I don't think they could have got it for that. So
now, has anyone else here been to London?
Have
you been to London? I have not. No.
Did you, when you were there, Lindsay, did you take a black cab somewhere?
I didn't. I took the tube, or I walked everywhere. Actually, I never had to take a cab.
The only time we took a black cab was we took a black cab at a couple different places. We took one in Liverpool, and that was a great experience because the dude was a blast. As you would expect from a cab driver in Liverpool, just super charismatic and funny. But the other one was an absolutely terrible experience that we had in London. And because we were like roaming around the city and it's our last night, so we got a hotel near the airport, which Heathrow Airport is great compared to like LaGuardia, but it's also still bad. Mm-hmm. So we go into London. And they were like, all right, we'll just get a cab to take us to our airport, to our hotel at the airport, because there wasn't a tube station nearby. So we get this cab. It's literally the most expensive cab ride I've ever had. The dude got lost at one point. And then at the end, when we get to the hotel, he was like, I don't take cards. It's like, your sign says you take cards. He's like, no, I don't take cards. So I had to go in and get cash while the meter was running.
Oh,
and the whole thing, like I literally reported this guy to whatever the London Black Cab Authority or whatever,
mm-hmm.
but it was a disaster, and it was like the exact opposite of Clark's friendly, helpful cab driver in this movie. Although I would love to have blasted this cab driver in the nuts with a briefcase or something.
But the joke though is that Clark gets
people from England are really nice.
Yeah, it's like everybody he runs over, he has like multiple auto accidents. Oh no, that's fine. I'll just put that in the back. And I was like, this isn't that the joke about Canada? Like I think that was the joke about
London. Well, Canadians come from somewhere, Jay.
They grow in London and then ship over.
All right. So here's a fun story. Another fun story because I'm just. Ruin this podcast with my bullshit.
It's Ron's fun story time, everybody.
But it was funny because the thing about everyone in London being polite and nice is kind of true.
Okay.
Like, so we get off at like St. Pancras because we're both starving because we've just got off an airplane and took the tube in for like an hour into actual London. And so we get off just at a random stop and we go up and get a burger at this place. And then we come out having eaten. And the first thing I run into is this old lady who looks at me and looks at my beard, because I still had the beard in like 2012. And she's like, in this thick Eastern European accent, she's like, you know, if you weren't white, we would think you were one of those people and we would be afraid of you. Talking about like Muslim, whatever, terrorists or extremists or whatever. And so I'm telling my friends the story. I'm telling Sarah and Craig the story, and I'm laughing, and they both look horrified that someone did this to me. I'm like, oh God, I'm so sorry. It's like, no, I think it's hilarious. It's okay.
Yeah.
Like, that's funny. That's funny to me because I'm a terrible American.
We're used to being rude to one another. So when someone does it, it's just like making home, right? I haven't been overseas, but it's the times I've been above the border and below, it's the same situation. Somebody would do something weird and I would think nothing of it. And the people that were local were like, oh, that's not really how everyone is, you know?
Yeah. Every person, like I told that story to, and I told that story several times because, like, what else am I going to talk about while I'm there? Because they were like, oh, how was London like? Blah, blah, blah. You know, these nice local friends, a bunch of people from Dinner Geek that I met or whatever. And I would tell them the story, you know, over drinks or Indian food or whatever. And they would just be like, make the most shocked, like, aghast faces. Like I said, well, I came out of the subway and somebody took a dump in their hand and threw it at me.
Wait, why are you talking
Which
about
might
your trips
happen
to
in New York?
I was going to say, you're talking about your trip to Philly or New York.
I was just going to say, or Philly. It could be Philly too.
Depending on what you're wearing.
Philly was batteries.
That's true.
Philly's, they do like to throw batteries.
Yeah. I do love the thing that reminded me of is sort of the picturesque way London is pictured. Cause my movie point of reference for London besides James Bond films as a kid was The Great Muppet Caper, which I will contend is the greatest Muppet movie of all time, and someday we will talk about that. But it's because it has a Bond people in it, but it's so it's just everyone's just so like singy and dancy and nice, and it topped off by freaking Eric Idle getting vehicular manslaughtered like at least 10 times in this movie. Like, just basically they hired him to just come do Monty Python shit. And he and Chevy were trying to come up with like a vacation movie together. They couldn't come up with anything better because they were both too drunk, apparently. But I thought that was funny. The second time they see him, when he's like, he's going into his hotel and he sees him there and he's like, no, I'm way across town. You'll never see me again. He has to run away from him.
Well, after he gets hit the first time too, he even says, oh, it's just a flesh wound.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
His wrist starts like, yeah.
The Saturday Night Live blood spray.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. It's this ridiculous amount of blood going on. So no, it's good.
All the car smashing too, especially right at first, was funny. When you consider, I don't know if either of you have ever watched Grand Tour with Jeremy Clarkson and the other two escape me. I'm sure they're not listening to this podcast, so it's fine. But
well, they're not after this.
Yeah, I know. They're all British. They're British, but they talk about how Europeans really don't give a shit about their cars and what happens to them. More specifically, French people or in France, they just don't care if their cars get destroyed. That's why they buy them. And I think it's a little bit like that in any major city. Like in DC, if you go to DC, you park parallel by like bumping the two cars in front of and behind you. And people just know that that's how you do it.
I just thought Stallone did that in the Cobra movie. That was the only person I thought that did that in America, but you know.
No, it's, yeah. I think it's a thing in a lot of cities, but in DC especially. Oh, and people have like nice cars in DC, but it doesn't matter. Like, they're all banged up.
Nearly 25 years of working on college campuses, I have had to accept the door dings that will happen from parking amongst the college kids.
Oh, yeah, door dings.
It's, it's, yeah, all day. It's like all kinds of stuff happening. So, speaking of which, I saw someone try to drive off recently with one of those like wheel locks, on their car.
Oh,
and they got one roll of the boot, and then that thing was like laid over on its side like a demented turtle. It was very sad. No, I love that. You know, the car antics really kind of go until they get to Stonehenge, where he knocks Stonehenge completely over. And all I was thinking was, that's how Connell Cochran got some of that over to Samir to do the Halloween 3 action, was a piece of it was broken off by Clark, and you know, somehow they sold it off, you know, because they had to get Stonehenge put back together. But that's the old joke, though. You go somewhere and like you touch something and it just falls apart, right? Like, that's yeah.
We can't have nice things. I love the very clear scale, like the very clear not to scale model of Stonehenge that they pan to after he knocks it over.
Stonehenge was in danger of being crushed by Clark Griswold. So, yeah.
The druids.
Yes. I cackled at all of that, for mostly for Spinal Tap reasons, but also because Chevy is great in that scene. But it's when they go to Paris that everything really starts to go bad, because I knew that the second that the camera was stolen and Beverly D'Angelo turned around, I was like, "You erased that tape, right?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure, of course." I was like, "Oh no, he did not." And that I had forgotten that about this movie. I was like, "Oh yeah, that's definitely going to come back into play now." I just forgot how it got played.
Now, has anyone been to Paris?
Oh.
No, I was stuck in the Paris airport for about 8 hours once, but I never left the airport. Yeah, Parisians are not nice, and they do not give good directions, especially in reference to which gate you need to go to. So, flight missed, 8 hour delay.
Oh,
that was
ouch.
That was my Paris experience.
Now, I will say, and when you get outside of the airport, when people start depending on you for your money, they're much nicer.
Okay, yeah. Well,
and yeah, I will say that every time I spoke to someone in Paris in French, they responded to me in English because they could hear my accent.
Understand you better, yeah.
Wait a minute. I've known you all these years. I didn't know you spoke French, too. So, wow.
I spoke French like 10 years ago or 15 years ago, yeah.
Oh, wow.
You lose it.
I think we're going to have to figure out a way to work that into the podcast somehow someday.
If you don't lose it, if you don't use it, you lose it. Lost it like nobody's business.
This is yet another reason we need to review Top Secret, just so you can be Chocolate Mousse on the show. So I killed everybody with that one. Awesome.
Sure as hell did.
They broke us. Yeah. And that concludes our podcast. You can follow us on the show social.
But okay, so like this is my fear, though, of ever going anywhere where I don't know people and stuff. I'm not handing nobody anything because like it's gone.
No, you shouldn't.
Yeah, like no, that's
you should not do
where they were. You don't even have that camera out because it will get stolen.
Yeah,
that was the thing that we were told a lot about in Paris. Is anytime you go to any of the tourist traps, the Eiffel Tower, anywhere, you keep all of your stuff in a front pocket, and you keep your hands over top of it if you want to keep it. Because the group we were with, someone did get her purse pickpocketed while hanging out at the base of the Eiffel Tower, which I did not go up in the Eiffel Tower because it was like an hour and a half wait. And, you know, I'm in Paris. I got more important things to do. Like,
right.
Like eat bread.
Yeah, like eat the best pain au chocolat that I've ever had.
Oh. It sounds good sitting over here. So,
as you should.
Yeah. But I love how again, just the way that they bumble through the city. But I got to say, like, personally for me, the Germany part is the favorite part, because first they just roll up on those people who they think are like Aunt Edna and Uncle Frank or whatever. And those people just go along with it. And who the hell those people beats the shit out of me? I have no idea. And I thought that was hilarious because the Griswolds just bulldozed them for like 24 hours. And they're just like, well, I guess this is what we do. We're nice to people, so.
So there was when they come in, I can't remember what the name of the street name is, but it was like Dusselstrasse or Strasse. But Chevy Chase pronounces it
Dipple
Strabe. Yeah. And Brian,
Strabler, yeah.
my Brian, who took many years of German and speaks a little bit of German still, thought that was the funniest bit, I think, in the whole movie. He laughed so hard, and I was like, "What? What'd I miss?" And he goes, "He said Strabe." And I said, "I still don't get it." And he goes, "They're not B's, they're S's. It's Strasse, like street." And I was like, "Oh my God." But he said it so confidently. He thought
Yes,
it was
yeah.
the funniest, like the funniest delivery.
And
So I never knew that that was a joke.
it's especially funny because the whole time he's talking about all of his German relatives, you would think he would have
He would
the
know, right?
mildest amount of knowledge of German, but no.
But no, Clark Griswold would not. Yes, a normal person would, but Clark, this is what we come to expect. And that's what gets me about this movie is because I remember thinking and having before revisiting it this time, and it had been several years since I've seen it, that I was like, oh yeah, this is the one that's not that good. But I was like, no, it's exactly the other movie. It's just all in Europe. Like literally, when you see the first Vacation, you realize like how much of it is it. The only thing that's missing is Christie Brinkley and the fucking Ferrari. Like this movie is the same movie again and
Which
again.
Jay's not upset about.
Which not remotely. But
So they should have gotten like Claudia Schiffer in like a
oh,
Maserati or something.
Ferrari
Yes, right. Or
yes.
just the Ferrari
Or a
again.
Porsche. It's you know,
Yeah.
yeah, so any of that. But yeah,
Oh yeah.
it would have been good to I wonder it, I guess in 85 Brinkley was probably married to Billy Joel at this point. So I think Innocent Man had come out at that point. She had been in the Uptown Girl video. That was the start of all that. So maybe she was busy doing whatever they were for all those years.
Billy
But
Joel stuff.
Billy Joel said, man, yeah, I was about to say making Billy Joel kids, but I mean it's just the one. But anyway.
I mean, how long does it, I mean, how much time does it take up to get a bunch of DUIs? Come on.
I mean, I don't know.
Depends on how committed you are, Ron.
But speaking of committed, though, I got to give my man Rusty a little bit of a shout out here. The man has tried to run game on everybody, and he's failed miserably until the German beer wench just, yeah, sure, just goes for it. And I, as a young, impressionable boy, I thought, oh, is that how it works? That is, narrator, that is not how
I
it
just go to
works.
Germany.
I mean, to be fair
Narrator,
to
that's
be fair to
not how
Rusty, he might be the only person within like 15 miles who's not vomited on her. So,
right.
like,
This
you
is
know.
true.
This is true. So I, yeah, but I love the, I give my favorite parts of the Germany parts because the whole put upon family thing. And then the way Clark turns that folk dance into like fucking Streets of Fire all of a sudden in the middle of this. It's gang warfare all of a sudden. It's hilarious.
And Rusty's reaction to
Yeah.
his, I guess, I'm assuming seeing boobs for the first time or like in person,
Yeah, real ones.
his
Yeah. He,
reaction is
yeah.
so believable. I'm like, that's
Yes.
exactly what a teenage boy would probably look
Can
like in that
confirm.
situation, like that was a perfect reaction. And then when she goes, oh, those bells haven't sounded in 100 years, someone's gonna be hanged, and he just goes, Dad!
Dad, he's like immediately, he knows. That's why I say, like, they don't get a lot, but when the kids get a moment to do a thing, like, they both get that. When we've skipped it already, but Dana's Audrey's called the boyfriend, and Dad gets the Clark's checking out of the
Oh,
hotel in London, and he gets the bill, and he's like, Audrey, and just a look on her face, like, yoinks, you know, or whatever. And then this is Rusty's moment. Like, they both get that, and I was like, yeah, that was well done. And then, of course, they run out, and it's all hell breaking loose behind them. But it's funny. But then Rome is where everything falls apart, right? Because they're all kind of irritated at each other. Which if you vacationed with people for more than like 2 days in a row, like you're ready to kill somebody, right? At some point. So, and which everybody
Can
relates to,
confirm.
right? So you got to figure the boundaries out. It's important. But I love how all of it falls apart at the same time, while also some things get better at the same time. Because at this point, I think Audrey's figured out that Jack has dumped her or whatever, and or she thinks he has. And so she is trying to move on to anything else and also be incredibly depressed. And at that point, Rusty like apparently catches the eye of Moon Zappa or something like that, who's also vacationing with her family. And I was taken back to a very sweet moment when I was in eighth grade of probably one of the first times a girl actually actively flirted with me in my life. I was in a hotel swimming pool and this girl who was definitely my age just swam up next to me and started talking to me, and she put her hand on my shoulder and I was like, I can die now, it's okay. So I felt very much in the space with Rusty there. I was having a moment.
I have a very similar story, except it wasn't a hotel pool, it was a hotel Lazy River.
Oh,
and we better. Just went around the Lazy River for like hours.
Yeah
That's so sweet, you guys.
Yeah, we were. I was a hopeless romantic even back then. So
I'm just hopeless.
Well, you know.
Did you guys also get too tall too fast and didn't know how to use your like arms and legs? Correctly?
Lindsay, I was 6 feet tall in eighth grade. So.
Cannot relate to that.
So
even close.
Did not go well. So let's just say. But it's why my ankles are as shot as they are now. It's because of that. But I love the coup de grace, though, is when Ellen sees that billboard and she just loses her shit on him. I cackled. I had to rewind it and listen to it again because I wanted to hear it again and because I felt like I missed a lot of dialogue because I was laughing so hard at that. Because I can only imagine what her, like, what an actual real reaction would be. Like, my wife would murder me twice in front of everybody and then yell at me. So, I don't know. I just got a kick out of it. I really loved what Beverly D'Angelo does in that scene.
Yeah. And then just storms back to the hotel.
Yes.
And starts drinking.
It's
as she should.
Obviously, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the better, like, sequences of the movie for her.
Mm-hmm.
I just have to wonder about, what do you guys think about the traveler's check place being robbed / the guy being held for ransom thing that kind of leads into this?
I felt like they had to shove something in there to have a reason for everything they wanted to have happen. And it felt like a riff on Roger Moore, James Bond movies in a lot of ways, who were at the time were kind of silly and would have these sort of silly side villains and even main villains sometimes. I it's almost too much, but I feel like the fact that they got an actor like Victor Leneau to know what he was doing, that it's just enough. Like, he serves just that perfect Eurotrash Pepe Le Pew kind of thing that he's got going on that just makes it work. I don't know. That's, I know he's in Rome, but he came off very Pepe to me.
Yeah, I can see the Pepe. I honestly did not even give that robbing another consideration. It was just, it wasn't part of the movie for me, but I also didn't mind it being there. It didn't, I mean, it was a catalyst for all of the events, but at the end of the movie I didn't think, wait a second, they never explained what that was all about.
I just took it as like those people were like Wolfgar's lesser smart cousins, Ron. They were trying to carry on his work from Nighthawks after Stallone had taken him out, and so I felt like that's what they were doing with it. Only if Rutger Hauer could have been the heavy would it have been perfect.
But, much more frightening movie.
Yeah, it was taking a real dark turn if Rutger Hauer walked on the set at that point. This was long after Blade Runner and stuff, so he was doing all these things. But yeah, it's before The Hitcher, though, which is a great performance.
Also, though, just in general, traveler's checks is a weird concept
right
to
now,
because I didn't really grow up. Yeah, like I don't remember my parents ever having traveler's checks either. They very well may have when I was younger, but we didn't really go anywhere that required them.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had traveler's checks when I went to Paris.
Oh, wow.
So yeah. It was an option when I studied abroad in college, but at that point, credit cards and debit cards worked everywhere, so we didn't really.
Well,
I mean, we still had to go and get our money exchanged a few times, but
they worked for me too in Paris, but the exchange rate You lost
it's
was
crazy, yeah.
Was a lot more kinder to travelers' checks, probably because they were trying to prop up that industry.
Yeah, that's totally. When we went to Canada, I remember we had to exchange out so much money, and then when Rachel went to Italy, we ordered money for her from, you know, the bank here in America. They got it and, you know, sent it to her or whatever. And it was just in this big envelope. It actually felt very 80s and espionage-ish. I was carrying this envelope full of, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Cash is definitely king.
yeah. No, it was more like the 67 Casino Royale with me. But anyway, but I love how Clark goes off on his own, right? He's like, he's determined to hit all the sites, you know, which is, this is also a trope from the first movie and is something that carries through all these movies, I think. And I joked about it, but he invents selfies, y'all. He gets that little flat camera and he's like,
yeah.
And I was like, Clark Griswold's invented found footage movies, home porn, and selfies all the same movie. And I was like, well, no, home porn probably been around at that point, Jay, but he did do found footage and
also some non-nutritive cereal varnish to maintain his crunch and milk.
Right.
I love Clark Griswold's profession. Yes. Cracks me up because it's definitely a real profession, but who does that?
Right. It's the most random thing, and that's what makes it perfect. You know, he's basically a chemist. Like, he's a high priced chemist, but he doesn't say that.
There's actually a place here that does that with food flavorings instead of like food additives.
Didn't realize it was
incredibly
real.
Incredibly lucrative.
Yeah,
it's a big thing in New Jersey, actually. Two of the biggest, I guess, food flavor plants are located in New Jersey.
Y'all, I learned about this when I worked at a school that was a big ag school for all these years. I thought this was a fake thing until those years. And I was like, oh, this is like freaking real. And not only is it real, it's real expensive. It's like, I met people from like AKG out in, you know, Nebraska and stuff would come to campus and recruit all these, you know, crop farmers and stuff that were at the university. So it was kind of wild to think about.
How much do you guys, there's got to be a Reddit post on this, and it just occurred to me, how much do we think Clark Griswold is pulling in a year?
Oh man.
In his chemistry to have a family with a house in the suburbs of Chicago.
Yeah. And
a stay-at-home wife.
In the 80s, he's pulling six figures at least in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like nowadays, he'd be like a senior VP or something. He'd be making some serious dough. He'd have a lot of stock. So Clark also struck me as the kind of guy, and when you meet his family in Christmas Vacation, you can almost confirm it, who came from a little bit of money too. And so did Ellen. Like, they both had a little bit of money, but then they had that one part of the family that didn't get any of it. But they both kind of struck me as people that had a little dough. I'm not talking about like Rockefeller money, but
they grew up comfortable.
Yeah, they were upper middle before there was an upper middle. So that's the way I took it, at least. I mean, God, look at the frig. Like, he pays that phone bill. He's not happy about it, but he pays it in cash. I was like, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Clark's got some dough. I agree. So, but I do love him going off on his own. But Ellen, of course, falls right into the thieves' hands, you know, crying on the shoulder of Pepe Lestrange here or whatever at the bar. And I do love, though, that I made that joke of the plot summary, but it dawned on me watching it this time. I was like, this is kind of like the comedic Taken in a little bit when Clark goes on the scene. He's like, well, I'm just going to use all my bumbling goofiness to thwart the evil. And I got a kick out of this. It was very Benny Hill, but I thought it was funny. It was par for the course.
Yeah, it's really funny to see Clark's aggressive driving skills come back into play. Yeah.
Chekhov's bad driving is what happens. But yeah.
I like Audrey in the passenger seat too when he's driving. And then Rusty and his new lady friend just hop in a car. And as Rusty's new lady friend, she was just like, all right, I'm in.
She's a cool California girl, Lindsay. That was her whole thing. You know?
She's such a cool California girl.
Yeah, she thinks
what
she's
do you say
cute.
You want to go? You want to go grind some Grimace portions? Is exactly how he asked her to go get food. And I was like, wait a second. Yeah.
When did Pauly Shore make a cameo in this movie?
Well, Moon Zappa was the first Valley Girl.
This is true. This is very true. So, yeah. But I liked it. I thought it was cute. Everybody kind of got what they wanted ultimately out of this when it was all said and done. So, but we didn't talk about when they go shopping and the ridiculous fashion they roll out in. Oh,
nice.
I mean, it's like the Money for Nothing video comes to life from Dire Straits or something. That Art Deco sharp edge zoot suit that Clark's got on.
And I love when Rusty comes out in his like Luke Skywalker jacket.
Yeah.
And Audrey's like, you look amazing.
Yeah.
And the and Beverly D'Angelo in the Art Deco hat and coat combination.
You know what? So good in that, though.
I swear.
Like, she looks so good in it.
I swear Tim Burton and Catherine O'Hara ripped that off for her in Beetlejuice.
I would fully believe that because that's definitely.
Yeah.
That's the same thought I had, Jay.
Yeah. I was like, this is. And I had it on the brain because I'm thinking about the new Beetlejuice, but I was like, oh, that's so the mom from Beetlejuice. It's very much that fashion. So.
And it nudged close to the Nicholas Guest and Julie Louis-Dreyfus from Christmas Vacation too, yes. And some of the crazy things they were wearing.
I don't know, Margot. Yes, yes. Todd and Margot.
To be continued. I'm going to watch that movie every week.
But I mean, really, though, it's funny. But, of course, the I think the most ridiculous gag is the very end here where Clark, like, it's almost like a 24 second remake of the incredibly superior comedy Airplane, where Clark falls through the cabin door because he thinks it's the Louvre. And I was like, man, that was back when you could get within 4 feet of the cabin before they tased you. It was a different world, kids, back in the 80s. Wow.
With the big... giant oversized plane seats where the tray folds into the arm. I remember that in some planes.
There was a smoking section on the plane, y'all. Did you see that?
What a time to be alive.
I mean, wow, what a different world. But I love that they run, you know, the Statue of Liberty's thing, you know, she drops her torch or whatever. Rusty's like, well, we're back. Of course. That's about it.
And you get this great montage over the end credits of Scenes of America.
Yeah.
And also the most famous National Lampoon cover of the dog with the gun to its head.
Yes. Yes. That, yeah. You get that. So, it was an interesting revisit because it had been a long time since I watched this one, but there was so much more in it that I had remembered was. You know, comedy gold is a part of it.
Also, I had forgotten that the guy at the hotel in London, the receptionist guy, was Mel Smith, who was in a lot of the Young Ones, Filthy Rich and Cat Flap, Alias Smith and Jones, all those kind of things back in the 80s. And also, he played the Chico role in Brain Donors, which was a remake of A Night of the Opera with John Turturro as the Groucho Marx character.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So. Which that is on the list of things to do, like that's on the list of things to do for the podcast and that I've had forever. But
I miss the 80s because it feels like that was the decade, at least that I was most aware of, all of these just random cameos like that would happen. You know, Eric Idle, maybe being the most famous one in all of this. And I miss a time when that wasn't, I guess nowadays, like it would just be so obvious or it would be spoiled to death and you would know it, you know, but it's fun that this movie lived at a time when that was part of life.
Hagrid was the guy in the bathroom.
Yes. Yes. I remember Robbie Coltrane. Yeah. Robbie Coltrane, very young Robbie Coltrane. My first Robbie Coltrane experience was, it was this, but me knowing that name was Goldeneye 10 years after this.
Yeah.
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 Oh yeah.
It's an underrated Bond flick, by the way.
We actually just watched that like last week.
I need to go. This is the time of the year. November is the time of the year I usually, before Christmas movies take over, is when I usually do revisit some Bonds, and I need to go. I've watched a couple, but I need to go back and hit a few from the Brosnan era. It's been a while. Yeah. So
that's what we did when we were both. We both had some kind of bug, and so we were stuck inside and couldn't do anything for the weekend, so we just binged a bunch of Bond movies.
It's a great way to spend a weekend.
It really was. Highly recommend.
The second old guy that Clark is with his car, the older man, he is the Major Gowan from Fawlty Towers.
Okay, see, I knew that face, and so I'm glad you remembered who it was.
Yeah.
So, no, excellent.
And the look on their face on the plane when they see the Statue of Liberty, when they're just like, oh, man, we're not home, but we are back in our home country and it feels so good, was so real. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt that in my soul having even if you've never been out of the country, if you have been on a long vacation in quotation marks. To get home is just like the biggest sigh of relief in the whole universe sometimes. Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. I also, the look on Chevy Chase's face, and I'll never forget this. I always felt like if they got a real person to play Bullwinkle the Moose, it could have been Chevy Chase, because he's got the eyes down.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Chevy Chase as Bullwinkle the Moose. You heard it here first.
I would have paid to see that.
Oh, man. Well, I think that brings us to the end here, guys. I think it's time for final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings. Ron, let's start with you, bud.
So, like Jay, I remembered this as being the lesser of the original three vacation movies. And I actually remember it less fondly than Vegas Vacation, because I think the stuff with Rusty in Vegas Vacation is some of the better stuff they've done with Rusty. The unintentional luck gambling streak that he goes on in that movie is pretty great. And the way he responds to it is very funny. But yeah, it's been a long, long time since I've watched this. I was very pleasantly surprised to see, oh, that's that guy. That's that guy. That's so-and-so. The cameos were fun. And I had a good time with the movie, and Beverly D'Angelo's line responded to, what did you call him, Jay? Pepe Le Thief.
Yeah.
when he's like, it's a shame to see a beautiful woman drinking bad wine. And she says, well, then I think you need to leave now because I'm going to get trashed. That was the funniest line in the movie to me, and just absolutely perfectly delivered by her. She really has chops for comedy, and just in general, because if you've seen any of her dramatic roles, she's really good, like as the mom in American History X or in Coal Miner's Daughter. She's got a long career of being great and stuff in small roles and in big roles. But yeah, I remember this movie fondly enough, and having rewatched it for the podcast, I realized, you know, it's more than just nostalgia. It holds up really well, and it holds up. It's very funny, even to this day for me. So I'm going to go with a medium popcorn with extra butter. Not quite a large popcorn because it drags in a few places, but I really had a good time with it.
Yeah, I feel like the same way you do, Ron. I remember this one missing something or lacking something and then coming back to it. No, it pretty well has all of it. It's, like I say, in a lot of ways, it's a... almost a Gus Van Sant shot for shot remake of the first movie. It's just in Europe in a lot of ways. There's parts of it that do drag a little bit, that do fall apart, but there's so much of it that, and maybe it's because I'm older and I'm just nostalgic for a lot of the stuff in it, you know, but it reminded me of things that I lived and went through and that I saw, you know, friends go through or parents or whatever. And the other thing about it is that it's not a movie that asks a whole lot of you. You just kind of sit back and just sort of kick your feet up. It's like a 60 degree afternoon. You're just going to kick your feet up on the back porch, put a little something on the grill, get a little something cold in your hand, and just kind of let the breeze just roll on by. And that's what this movie is. And so it's a easy watch and is very fun and deserves more credit and part of that original trilogy than it probably will ever get. And you know, we can talk about the others someday, but for this movie, yeah, I'm with you. Super medium popcorn, like that perfect. They just switched over from the leftovers from the night before. They got the new popcorn in for the, you know, the new Marvel bomb that's out that weekend. So you get the first run and you get the butter on it and it's all good. So yeah, medium popcorn for me too, with extra butter.
This is so important because sometimes a medium popcorn can be better than a large popcorn if you get the fixins right. And I think that European Vacation is exactly that. It's that medium popcorn that's maybe just a little better than a large, just a regular large with the extra butter, as you guys said, maybe some of that like cheesy sprinkle that you can get at the theater at whatever your local grocery store chain is. And of course, having not seen the original, as you know, I can't really put them in appropriate order. Christmas Vacation will always be my top, top, top refillable bucket of popcorn that you can get at a theater. And then Vegas Vacation, I also really liked as well, Ron. I've seen that one so many times and it's so funny. And European Vacation, I would put under that, but that doesn't mean that I don't like it. Like I said, watched it twice just this month so far already, partially because of the podcast, but also just because I wanted to. And I don't know. It's just, it's really fun. I'm going to second Jay's. You just sit back and enjoy the ride and enjoy the Griswolds and their crazy dynamic and their interpretation of what all of these countries act like when Americans come to town. And it's just so fun. So I will make it a hat trick and give it a medium popcorn with the extra butter, just the perfect amount of everything popcorn, but in a medium. So
I gotta say, this idea of doing a National Lampoon's November moment, it was perfect, Lynn. So credit to you for coming up with that and pushing us to that. But I think because of where we're heading around and what time it almost is, our second chapter, whatever it was going to be, we just need to put that on hold. I think we need to do Christmas Vacation as a good lead into December. So I'm going to throw that.
I think
up
we
the
did that
now.
Last year, Jay. Oh no, yeah. Did we do Christmas Vacation already?
No, we haven't done Christmas Vacation yet. No,
we must have done it on Tis the Podcast.
Yeah,
or something.
I think
we
you guys
did
have
it
talked
with someone.
You guys have talked about it on Tis the Podcast, but we've never done it on this show. So I think it's time to pull the Band-Aid off and do that here, because it's a great lead into December. So as well.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm here for it. I am here for it. I'll do that movie. I'll watch that movie anytime. I recently watched Daddy's Home 2, which is a Christmas movie with Mark Wahlberg, Will Ferrell. I don't know if you guys have seen it or not, but there is a John Cena plays cameo at the very end, and they talk about how much he loves that Christmas time song. And at the end of the movie, he goes, "Damn, I love this song. I'll play this shit in August. I don't even care." And that is how I feel about Christmas Vacation.
Christmas Vacation is a regular part of our Christmas in July.
Yes. Yep. I support it. I do. But anywho, thank you. Thank you very much, guys, for your commentary and colorful antics, as always. much like the Griswolds, you are my podcast family. And looking forward to the rest of National Lampoon November. For the rest of you, please follow the show's social media at FilmStrip Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. There you will find announcements about upcoming shows and a link to our Letterboxd page, which contains our entire list of reviews. Go to filmstrippodcast.com to link to our Anchor FM distribution site, where you can find your podcast platform of choice, Apple, Spotify, Google, etc. And please share the show. And if you can, leave us a positive review. It helps other people find the podcast. And for Ron and Jay, I'm Lindsay. Thank you for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.